This episode, I am joined by philosopher Sebastian Vurush to discuss the work and legacy of Francisco Varela. I'd like to say a big thank you to all my paying patrons and subscribers for making all of this work possible. And if you'd like to support the podcast as it runs off patronage alone, please find links in the description below. Otherwise, please enjoy. So, Sebastian Vurush, thanks very much for joining us on Emetics Podcast.
Thanks very much for inviting me. It's a pleasure to be here, James.
So we are going to be discussing the work of Francisco Varela, who was a Chilean philosopher, biologist, psychoanalyst, and many other things. Very holistic thinker. So I will say before we start this, like Varela is, as we were just chatting about before we got started recording here, Varela is one of these thinkers who, if you say, you know, which I'll ask you right at the end, where do you begin with this person's work? You hear about this person's work, where do you begin? And anyone who knows about his work, I mean, you know, I only read what you sent me, but anyone who knows anything about his work will go, because he is eclectic, holistic. And it's one of those philosophers where, you know, you might read a few things and then you go, yeah, but you also need to read this, you need to read this. And it grows and grows and grows and builds and builds and builds. And it's sort of recursive and in that manner. So to sort of say what his work is about at this beginning stage is very, very difficult. But before we jump in with Varela, just tell us a little bit about yourself, what it is you do and how it was you came across Varela, the work of Varela.
Okay, so I'm an associate professor of philosophy currently at the Faculty of Arts at the University of Ljubljana. I have a similar issue as probably many of your other guests here and yourself. Maybe I am. I have a tendency to be interested in way too many things at the same time. So. Like Varela himself, I'm a bit of a polymath, but my main focus currently is on the phenomenon of life. So I originally, my PhD was on mystical experiences, actually. And through the conceptualization of mystical experiences, I was doing studies. I was doing like a philosophical reflection on certain scientific studies that were done on mystical experiences, and then also some phenomenological investigations. And through this research, I became more and more interested in phenomenon of life because it seemed to be a very central notion, central concept to allow us to articulate these types of experiences, which usually somehow involve some sort of a breakdown of the subject-object barrier, so subject-object dichotomy. So the notion of life became central, and this is what sparked my interest in this particular phenomenon. So I'm mostly working on that at the moment, on non-reductionist approaches to life, on phenomena such as vital normativity, and all the different authors related to that. So in addition to Francisco Varela, Merleau-Ponty, Canguilhem, Plessner, Yona, several other authors. And also, I'm very interested, and this is something that will be a bit of a follow-up on my current research, is the relationship between vitality and mentality, between life and mindedness. So, you know, once you have a non-reductionist positive account of life that is not, say, reductionistic, so it's not basically life is just a sum of certain biochemical processes, you know, how does then mind enter the picture, mindedness? Because sometimes then life is simply equated with the mindedness. Some people try to differentiate them. So, you know, how does that work? And this is also how Francisco Varela enters the picture. He actually was important for my research and also my life in general, you might say, for two reasons. So first of all, You know those books that enter your life at the precisely right moment, mm-hmm. and later on you maybe kind of outgrow them a little bit, mm-hmm. but they still retain like a very special status. So the embodied mind, which was written by Varela, Thompson, and Roche, was that type of a book. So I have found myself in a really strange place where I've gone through what one might call some sort of a dark night of the soul. And I found myself in a really, really confused place where I was just I was trying to restructure various bits and pieces of my life and started developing interests in various disciplines, domains, traditions, but I didn't really know how to put them together. For instance, I've had a long interest in science, at the same time also in philosophy. Initially, I started as an analytic philosopher, but then slowly after this particular experience, I also became more interested in traditions such as phenomenology. And I also slowly started kind of drifting or dipping my toes into the realm of religion, theology, and so on. And, you know, these were just seemingly different separate islands in this vast ocean. I had no idea how to put them together. And then somehow this book, I come across this book and I read it. And for the first time, I found, you know, some sort of a glimmer of how this could potentially be done. Mm-hmm. Like I said, it's a book that eventually, you know, I've kind of, now that I've read it and reread it several times, I have several issues with some of the things and several concerns, and I think it's naive in some regards, but still it will always retain this like special place because it came to me at the right time. That's one thing. And the second thing was Francisco Varela, basically, as I became more interested in his work, opened up these almost magical doors to all these other traditions and authors that I've then started exploring. And I've already mentioned some of them. Merleau-Ponty, Canguilhem, and so on and so forth. And I will be eternally grateful to him for that particular reason, for introducing me in a certain sense to these traditions. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So I guess with any philosopher, a good question is to sort of, if we can, build a foundation is, I mean, who is Varela and what was his philosophical lineage? Who was it? Who were the key figures that he was drawing on to build his approach?
Well, like you said, James, at the very beginning, so he was trained as a biologist, but he was so much more. He was also what later and nowadays is also known as cognitive scientist and a philosopher, cybernetician, like you mentioned. And he was just basically a modern polymath. He was someone who was capable of just drawing on very different traditions and creating these fascinating creative synthesis, and also able to build bridges, very interesting ideational conceptual bridges between what may seem like almost opposing traditions. So he was a very, very eclectic thinker. So he drew, consequently, he drew on many, many different authors and traditions. But maybe I could focus on four traditions, which he himself mentions on several occasions in his texts, and that were probably most influential in the development of his thought. The first tradition is cybernetics. Like you said, he was a cybernetician. And he was here influenced both by the first wave, so the first order, and the second wave, or the second order cybernetics. Let me briefly explain. So the first wave of cybernetics is something that developed in the second half of the 1940s and then 1950s to up to 1960s. And this was basically an attempt by people like
Norbert Wiener.
Yeah, Wiener was one of them, von Neumann was one of them, McCulloch. They basically tried to develop a science of communication, information, science of purposive systems, of guided systems. So eventually it just like became an attempt to construct a science or a meta-science of systems in general. And the idea was to really, really construct a rigorous, proper science. So it was a profoundly naturalist approach. However, they introduced a lot of new and interesting concepts, such as, for example, a feedback loop, the idea of recursivity, circular causality, the notion of complexity, and so on and so forth. So that was the first wave, and Varela was very much appreciative of the work that was done there. However, he was much more influenced by the so-called second order or the second wave of cybernetics. And this has to do with people like Bateson, so Umberto Maturana, who was Francisco's teacher and mentor, Gregory Bateson, and Heitz von Förster. So, and there were several others as well. The most significant move that happened here with the second order cybernetics was the following. If you want to construct the meta science of systems, you realize that you yourself as a scientist are also a system. So if you want to have a meta science of systems, you somehow have to include yourself into this particular epistemological equation, which means that, and this is the way how the move from the first order to the second order cybernetics is usually depicted, is that you move from the science of the observed systems to the science of the observing systems. So the observer gets included into the equation, and this was something that was tremendously influential and important for Varela. So cybernetics, that's one tradition. Then the second tradition was what he often refers to as the French history and philosophy of science. What he basically means, so young Varela was very much impacted by works of Coiré and also by works of Bachelard, whom you already have had an episode on here at Hermetics, and also Canguilhem and several other authors. The most important contribution of this particular tradition to Varela's thought was this recognition that scientific ideas, scientific concepts, theories don't just fall out of the sky, so to speak. They usually emerge, that they always emerge against a certain background, within a certain context, within a certain historical cultural context, and that you have to have a good understanding of this broader horizon, of this broader milieu, if you really want to understand the nature and the content of these concepts, theories, and so on and so forth. And the second thing that he took away from this was this idea that science does not develop linearly, so that there is like this non-linear development within science, which means that it includes a lot of jumps, breaks, leaps, and so on and so forth. This is, you know, most people associate this with Kuhn in the Anglo-American sphere. However, the French tradition has a lot of interesting thinkers who have done a lot of very, very interesting work in this field. So that's second tradition. The third tradition is phenomenology. So Varela, especially, this was something that was present from the very early years. So already when he was a student, he was reading phenomenologists, but it became even more pronounced in the 90s. So he was influenced primarily by Merleau-Ponty and Husserl, also, although to a somewhat lesser degree, by Heidegger, and then later also by people like Henri and Levinas. So he also mentions them occasionally in his later texts. Now, why was this so important for him? This fundamental recognition of phenomenology, that you have to take into account the domain of lived experience or aliveness or the sphere of existence. So if you talk about phenomena such as life and mind, which were like the central phenomena that Varela was interested in, you have to take into account that these are not just phenomena that you observe, but that you also live, that you live through. So it is your aliveness, so to speak, your vitality, the vitality that you currently live through, that anchors you into the world, so to speak. And phenomenology, to him, provided like these very fascinating pragmatic tools and also conceptual tools that allow one to really thematize these topics, these problems, these questions. Now, the final tradition that I would like to mention here is Buddhism. He was especially influenced by Tibetan Buddhist tradition. Mm-hmm. He had, usually he would mention two teachers, Chögyam Trungpa and Urgyen Rinpoche. So the main reason why this was interesting, like there are several reasons that, you know, we could basically have the whole episode on this probably. But the main reason why this was interesting, and to tie this to the previous tradition, is he felt that Buddhism actually provides you with hands-on, practical, pragmatic tools, how you can deal or investigate, engage with the lived experience. Mm. So not only you, for example, in the phenomenological tradition, you would have this idea that you always, if you want to investigate your experience, you have to perform epoche. You have to put into brackets your preconceived notions about what experience is like. Mm. But he says, Husserl talks about this constantly, yet he never really tells you how you should go about doing it. And he felt that the Buddhist tradition can provide a little bit of that, so that you literally have like these practices, techniques that would allow you to develop this. So these are the four main traditions. However, in addition to this, he was just kind of reading all over the place. You find references to Wittgenstein, Desjardins, De Biron, Kyoto School. So a lot of different thinkers and traditions.
So cybernetics, French philosophy of science of a certain era, phenomenology, which is Husserlian, and Tibetan Buddhism as the four possible main pillars. As you said, there's many others. So between these four, there is this focus on the role of the observer within the thing they are observing and the effects of the observer. But I guess in relation to that earlier discussion on, you know, what is it for mentality to be vital, to have an aliveness, is the strange reciprocal relationship between an aliveness which is investigating its own aliveness and has to take fact of its own aliveness as it investigates. It all seems very quantum in a strange sense. But between, like, from those four, could you, and I mean, you know, I'm thinking of all the articles you sent me and how eclectic they are. Of those four, could you possibly pull out, you know, I don't want to say central, but homogenized Valerian question, like direction question, what is the...
That's a good question. So one of the frustrating things about the Varelian opus is that, as I mentioned when we were chatting prior to the episode, unfortunately, Francisco, being such an eclectic thinker and constantly developing new ideas and kind of articulating and re-articulating the old ones, he died prematurely. He was only 54 years old, and he never really managed to tie some of the loose ends together. And, there's a good case to be made that he was trying to do this. However, usually when you study a certain thinker, you realize that there is like a very, very fundamental, almost visceral idea that is somehow permeating all of these different topics and themes that person is investigating. And I think that the best way to approach this is basically through a certain anecdote that both Francisco Varela and his already mentioned mentor, Umberto Maturana, were kind of mentioning in several of the texts. Namely, during their first meeting, when Varela was still a student and he wanted to join Maturana's lab, Maturana back then was already an established biologist. He came from Harvard and he came back to Chile, and, you know, he was having his own lab and doing very important work, and it was well respected in Chile. And Francisco Varela came for an interview, and Maturana asked him, you know, well, what is it that interests you the most? What would you like to do if you had the opportunity? And Varela, you know, with the enthusiasm of with a youthful enthusiasm, said that he would like to study the place and role of mind in cosmos or nature. And Maturana famously said, "That's perfect. That's marvelous. You've come to the right place. You're going to start by studying the vision in frogs." So this is how they met and how this exchange kind of supposedly took place. But I think that this, in a certain sense, illuminates precisely what you are after. So this central fundamental question that Varela was constantly struggling with. Namely, if we paraphrase it a little bit, how is it that you get something like mind, a certain whole, which seems to be somehow separate, yet at the same time related to the wholeness or the rest of nature. So how can you have these wholes that we call minds, or that are mind-like, yeah, that are at the same time somehow related to the rest of reality, yet separate? And this particular question, this particular problem, basically has, we might say, two dimensions to it. One dimension is that, and this is also something that comes up in several of Francisco's works, namely this recognition that there is a certain style of thought that has developed, say, in the 16th, 17th century. So the style of thought of the classical science, and he uses many different names for it. Sometimes he just refers to it as Cartesianism, although he's not referring explicitly to Descartes, but just this idea that what constitutes reality is that which can be, that which is mathematizable, mechanizable, and depersonalizable. So you know, that which you can account for in mathematical terms, that which you can account to in causal terms, and that which you can account for without any addition of the subject of the or the observer. So this is, you know, the what constitutes reality. And then you have the problem, well, what about all the other qualities and characteristics that don't fit, such as color, sounds, values, norms, and what have you. So you have this split, this bifurcation of nature, which happens, as Whitehead calls it. And he was aware that this was the predominant, still the predominant way of looking at things, not necessarily always explicitly articulated, but it was there as a horizon, ideational horizon, like a thought style that was permeating modern science and also most of modern philosophy. At the same time, there was a new thought style that was emerging that was kind of trying to move away from this idea that you have this schism or this split between the subjective and the objective, and the attempt to kind of bring those two together. And this was a very heterogeneous movement. It was not a uniform movement. It was both happening both within science and philosophy. And he saw himself as someone who was part of that movement. He was kind of, he saw the specific things that he was developing, the specific ideas, the specific notions, as contributions to this novel thought style that was being developed. And for him personally, he saw that, so his intuition was that in order to get through this split that I've mentioned between the subjective and the objective, this bifurcation of nature, two phenomena need to be revitalized, pun intended, as you will see, and also rekindled somewhat. And that is, on the one hand, the phenomenon of life needs to be thematized anew and brought into the picture, and the phenomenon or the concept of circularity. So circularity as something that is seen as negative, something to be shunned, he wanted to reintroduce that into the scientific and the philosophical discourse. So again, so this question of mind and how it's related to the world, and how to find this middle way where you don't have absolute separateness, but at the same time, one doesn't engulf the other. So the fundamental problem that you have with this, what he calls Cartesianist approach, which usually forces you into these extremes.
And this notion of circularity, this seems to be where, if Varela is known for sort of one thing, if you mm-hmm. check his Wikipedia page, for instance, he is most well known for the concept of autopoiesis, I believe it's pronounced that way.
Yeah.
And this, you know, this sort of self-regeneration within the autonomy of the subject seems to connect to this circularity. So this seems to be a good place to perhaps throw in his, you know, in a common sense, the most notable thing he's known for thus far. Hopefully in time he will be known for much more.
Yeah.
This is the main thing. So he introduced this notion into biology, correct?
Okay. Yeah, correct. With a small qualification.
Humboldt?
Umberto Maturana, yeah. His mentor that I mentioned. So this is precisely it, James. So when I said that one of his that his intuition was that in order to somehow gain a new way of thinking about this fundamental question, this visceral question that was kind of motivating his research and his work, that this requires us to, first of all, reintroduce life into the whole story. So the phenomenon of life is missing usually. What you usually end up with is have like consciousness versus matter. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And life is somehow usually subsumed under matter. It's just a complex form within matter. However, according to Varela, you know, the life acquires a life of its own, so to speak, within this story. I will get to that. And so reintroduction of life, and at the same time, this circularity that I mentioned becomes like a nerve, or the foundational stone of what he calls biologics, or the logics of life. Mm-hmm. And this is precisely nicely captured in this theory of autopoiesis, or of autonomous systems. So autopoiesis is something that basically Maturana, he first came up with this particular idea, and then Francisco Varela and Umberto Maturana, they together developed the whole notion, and they expanded upon it and developed like a theory, a proper theory. This was in when they were collaborating together in the early 70s. So after Francisco Varela, he did his PhD in Harvard, came back to Chile, and then he spent 3 years there. And this was like a very, very intense period where Umberto Maturana and Varela, they were collaborating a lot. And this is where basically the theory of autopoiesis and autonomous systems came to be. The fundamental idea is this, that living systems are basically self-producing systems. This is what autopoiesis means. So they self-produce, they self-maintain. And usually the way this is described, the notion of autopoiesis is usually used to account for the simplest life forms, so the cellular life forms. What you have is, you have a metabolic network, a complex metabolic network, which at some point produces, as part of this particular network, its own limit, its own membrane. So once you get this membrane, what gets constituted is a certain formation, a certain form. Mm-hmm. And what happens is you get this ongoing dialectics, ongoing movement between the emergent whole and the network that enables it. So basically, you have a metabolic network which brings forth a certain whole, which enables that particular network to function in a way that can bring forth this particular whole. Mm-hmm. So instead of having, for example, just the layer of biochemical processes, of metabolic processes, which would be a reductionistic account or approach, or having a layer of, let's say, life, which would be completely severed from any biochemical processes, which would be a vitalistic approach, where you have an additional principle added into the story. Francisco Varela and Umberto Maturana try to account for life by this ongoing loopiness, ongoing circularity, as they call it. This is autopoiesis. Again, where you have these processes which bring forth a certain system as a whole, which, however, allows these processes to unfold. And the main thing, the most important thing, is that it is a dynamic processual something. So you don't really get a thing which would be static. It has to constantly move just to stay the same. Mm. So the identity of the thing is basically an ongoing process, an ongoing minute change, which allows it to maintain itself as a unit. Okay, but the fundamental thing here is that you have a circular process, which, however, does not lead to a vicious circularity, but to a productive, virtuous circularity, as Varela puts it. So it is actually an effective, a formative process. And what I've just described on the level of a cell, Varela eventually expanded to other systems as well. So he said that this particular logic, this circular logic, which, by the way, he also tried to formalize. So he was developing formal languages, mathematical languages, to account for this circularity and have it included into the formal system in a way that would not lead to paradoxes. So, like I said, he was a truly, truly eclectic thinker. So he was, you know, doing mathematics at the same time. So he expanded this idea of autopoiesis to other systems as well. So his idea was, for instance, that our immune system is also structured in this particular way. And our nervous system also operates in this way. They are what he refers to as closed systems, not closed in the sense that there would be no exchange with the environment. The organisms are constantly in exchange with the environment. So the thermodynamical processes are constantly happening. But organizationally or operatively, the way that this particular system, once it gets constituted, operates, is closed in the sense of that all partial operations move within the system itself. So it's like one leads to another, and you don't really get out of the system. So they all together maintain this system as a whole. So this is the fundamental idea behind autopoiesis and autonomous systems, and how circularity enters the picture. So circularity is basically, like I said, the nerve of biologic, of vital logic, of the logic of life.
Well, any questions I had about that? I mean, my question usually would be, you know, what place does a boundary or a demarcation have? But you've explained that quite well, that, you know, this boundary is only to innkeep a sort of closed system, which is still within the whole, but it's just to contain a whole system. So I guess, in a way, just to, you know, from my reading, the other big idea for Varela was neurophenomenology. So just to throw that in, and then we have these sort of two cornerstones. We have these two.
Nicely done, James.
Well, it was a bit of a clunky intro, but I mean, well, I guess from what you've said so far, this we have autopoiesis, we have the subject object split. So neurophenomenology seems like this philosophical approach, obviously coming from Husserl, to understand, you know. To me, it seems like it has a lot of similarities with Heidegger, right? With Dasein, with Dasein as defined as the being which can analyze itself, except this for Varela possibly has been, I don't want to say flattened, but immanentized into the actual biology, the biology of that being itself as something something more. What am I on somewhat the right lines there or no?
Yeah. But before we get to neurophenomenology, I would just, if it's all right with you, I would just like to make a short detour, because it will make the transition to neurophenomenology easier, and it will make much more sense.
Okay.
So one of the ideas, and this is also something we were discussing, that Francisco Varela is also extremely well known for nowadays, is this idea of embodied cognition and inaction. And this notion of inaction ties in very nicely to what I was just describing when I was talking about autonomous systems. Let me just try to briefly account for why this is the case, and then try to kind of pave the way to neurophenomenology. So once you have this autopoietic or autonomous system, this emergent whole, because it is kind of operating as a unit, it no longer reacts automatically to external stimuli, but it responds in a way which allows it to maintain its internal coherence. Now, this is very interesting. So what happens is, once you have this autonomous whole, what happens is you get some sort of a proto-polarity or proto-normativity, you might say. So this whole establishes its own conditions of possibility, and it tries to maintain them, which means that its responses to external stimuli will be non-neutral. In other words, you get something like a primitive or a proto-directionality. Intentionality. You get a position out of which organism response. So there's almost like a small crack in the plenum of being which emerges, or at least a small fold, as Hegel would put it, or Merleau-Ponty. So you have a certain, let's say, point of view, a minimal point of view, and the organism responds to it in a non-neutral way, which means that this is how Varela then develops his idea. The organism will eventually kind of carve out its own domain of meaning or significance. So it will identify those patterns that are significant for it, that allow it to maintain its coherence. So sometimes Varela talks about the living being bringing forth or enacting its own milieu, its own world. He uses a term that he borrows from a relatively obscure to most people, I would assume, German biologist von Uexküll, which is Umwelt. So Umwelt is this milieu which is basically the domain of significance for a particular organism. Different organisms have their own milieus or Umwelten. Yeah, so they live in these milieus. So this is something that is very important, that all of a sudden, once you have this, let's say, dialectics of identity, yeah, dialectics of identity, which is related to autonomy, you get another dialectics, which is like dialectics of cognition and has to do with this notion of an action. And the thing is that these two movements have to happen at the same time. So on the one hand, the organism is always centering itself in itself by decentering itself into its own environment or milieu. So, you know, it is never fully centered and never fully decentered. It's an ongoing movement, and it lives as long as this movement happens. So this is very important, because at a very conceptual level, you have this idea of how you can bring forth, how you can move away from this idea that something that is in some way or another that could be characterized by a certain qualities that we usually attribute to subjectivity, mind, that you can move away from this idea that this has to be self-enclosed something. With Varela, as you see, you know, there's an imminent eccentricity to aliveness. Huh? Okay, so that's one thing. And now we're moving to neurophenomenology. So once you have this idea that every living organism, in a certain sense, just by being alive, constitutes its own milieu, domain of significance, we, scientists, philosophers, ordinary people, we are also living beings, which means that we also live in our own domains of significance. So our life world, our experiential world, the world through which we live and in which we are anchored, is basically our milieu. So all of a sudden, the domain of experience becomes not just some sort of a side product of brain activity. It is basically something that is essential and crucial for you to properly understand, if you want to understand living beings and living phenomena as such. So this is one way of thinking as to why, for Francisco, experience became really, really important, and why he at some point recognized that he really, really needs to find ways how to study experience really, really rigorously and methodically. Yeah. And this is what neurophenomenology is attempting to do. Neurophenomenology, basically the name is kind of a giveaway. Yeah. It tries to, as he puts it, combine the most top-notch research within the field of cognitive neuroscience and combine it with equally disciplined, rigorous, systematic exploration of lived experience. His idea being, if you really want to understand consciousness, mindedness, you will not be able to do this if you simply ignore the experience, the consciousness, the mind. So his idea is, we need to develop these rigorous, systematic tools, how we're going to study experience, consciousness, and so forth. And then we have to bring them together with this third-person approaches. So these first-person approaches need to be brought together with third-person neuroscientific approaches, and then slowly build bridges between them so as to gain a better account of what the phenomenon of consciousness and experience might encompass. I don't know if this was, if this made sense. We've covered a lot of ground, I know.
One thing
from the unicellular organisms to neurophenomenology. Yes,
I know we've moved fast. One thing I actually want to jump back to and throw a curveball in, just because it's a rare opportunity to do so. I mean, the only other philosopher I know who has used the work of Uxgal, especially the concept of Umwelt, is Peter Wessel Zapfer. So Zapfer's appreciation of the Umwelt in relation to the human beings is that the milieu we find ourselves within, human beings in almost a Darwinian sense, are, his words, too well endowed. So we know too much, so we can self-analyze our Umwelt from the position of the being that we are, but also that Umwelt will never be able to give us enough meaning to satisfy our analysis. This is just like the ultimate tragedy. Would Varela possibly have a more, you know, this is extremely pessimistic. Mm-hmm. Would Varela possibly have an optimistic inverted look at that?
Yeah. So maybe before I answer this question, just a little bit of a historical trivia, which you might find interesting. The notion of Umwelt at some point has proven to be extremely, extremely productive. And it was actually very important for Canguilhem's first important work, Normal and the Pathological, and Merleau-Ponty's first work, the Structure of Behavior. Mm. And they both got it through the works of Kurt Goldstein, this strange, almost completely forgotten German neuroscientist, who wrote a very interesting book called Der Aufbau des Organismus, or The Organism, where he tried to develop the idea of the organism as a whole. And he was a practicing, very, very influential neurologist in Germany, and then had to flee to the US in the 30s. For obvious reasons. And, you know, he had a big impact on early Merleau-Ponty and Canguilhem. And through Goldstein, they came also in touch with the works of Uxküll and his notion of Umwelt. And Varela, somehow just, you know, reading all these authors, he also kind of picks up this notion of Umwelt. Now, to your question, that's a very, very good question. And it touches upon one of the problems that I think are not really that Varela hasn't really provided an adequate answer to, namely the question of, so you have living beings, for example, having their own milieus. And at the same time, you might say that, you know, human beings, they also kind of live in and through their own milieus. But there's this question of whether with the human, what happens is that this domain of milieu changes somewhat. So, for example, why did I mention also Merleau-Ponty before? Because Merleau-Ponty, he was wedded to this phenomenological tradition that there is a difference between, say, animals' relationship to its milieu and the human relationship to its world. So even though it's really, really important to understand the vital dynamics and how, you know, this relationship between the world and the animal comes to be with the human being, what you get is an additional complexification, which leads to some sort of a qualitative change in this relationship. The capacity also precisely to add new recursivity. So you're able to reflect on things, reflect on your own relations. So you get relations to relations, which is basically, if you think about it, what reason is. It is a relation to relations. This capacity to reflect on a certain relationship. And I think that this might be something that Zapfer is alluding to, that this particular capacity makes it, how did you put it? Like too com? No, not
well,
too
well endowed. Like we know too much to ever be able to too well endowed, as his
Yeah, because you're never fully centered into your own milieu. Are Plessner has a very nice term here that he uses. He says that for the human being is characterized by eccentric positionality. So you're always rooted in a certain domain, but at the same time, you know, this domain is surrounded by a certain horizon of possible restructurations or alterations, modifications. You can always, in a certain sense, kind of leap out of it. You don't know exactly where you're leaping and what this will lead to, but there is a possible restructuration happening. And this is something that then reflects in your way of being in the world. And this is what Zafer refers to. And with Varela, this is interesting. When he talks about, for example, of the phenomenon of language, he comes close to something similar, to saying that the domain of mindedness with human beings then kind of opens up a certain novel level of complexification, which makes the whole dynamics different. But he never really fully articulates it. So you might say that he's kind of somewhat oscillates between human beings are also in their milieus, but this milieu is just very complex milieu, and a view which, once you attain a certain level of complexity, you get out of it. Now, whether this is like a positive or a negative thing, the pervading attitude, like, he was definitely not a pessimist. There's always a tinge of optimism in all of Varela's ideas. So he has this idea that, for example, in his later texts, especially interviews, he is very being very critical about certain developments in the sphere of technology. And in this sense, he was quite prescient with regards to what we're witnessing now. But at the same time, he was always emphasizing that this doesn't mean that we have to kind of hold on to a certain, let's say, endemic state, which was in the past. And because vital phenomena, mental phenomena, they're constantly changing. There are constant reconfigurations and restructurations. And we will go through another such restructuration. What is important is to find a way that we don't, I don't know, end up in some sort of a positive feedback loop where we just kind of spiral out into some sort of oblivion. But the thing is that there was a positive sentiment. So even though we may, I don't think that he would say we know too much. It's just you have to cultivate or train this particular capacity in a way that would allow you to use it to make wise, beneficial restructuration that may occur. So, you know, and this is also where, for him personally, this contemplative practice, broadly speaking, enters the picture. It really is like a way of cultivating these capacities. It is not just, you know, something to attain tranquility. It is, in a certain sense, almost like an epistemic tool, so to speak.
So when we, you know, when we talk about us humans beings being in the Umwelt, you know, I would say I'm in the Umwelt. I have Heideggerian sense of familiarity with the world, or I'm centered in this milieu. What is I? What are we? What is in it? What is a subject? You know, what is this? What is, you know, it's this strange position we find ourselves in where we are living beings that are being, that are also matter, that also are aware of their relationship with the world. And also have a reciprocal relationship with the world in biological sense. But this thing, I guess, once again, you know, it's not exactly Cartesian, but it is possibly Cartesian because it's not just thinking. But it's like, what is this thing that says, I'm here, you know?
Okay. So, yeah, that's another very important topic in Varela's work, the question of the self. It was important for him for several reasons. So on the personal level, and also one of the reasons why he got involved with Buddhism, and also in the context of his own research, in the context of the research in autopoiesis and action, embodied cognition, and so on and so forth. So if we go back to what I was describing, where you have this particular very dynamic and processual account of vitality, of life, which basically, as he depicts it and as I was trying to articulate it, consists of two constantly dialectics that constantly interweave. The dialectics of identity, this where you have parts and the whole kind of constantly co-constituting it out, each other. And then once you get this whole, you also have this dialectic between the outside and the inside. And they have to appear constantly just so as to maintain this emergent whole that is appeared. So you have to be kind of decentered in order to be able to be centered, and you have to be centered in order to be able to be decentered. And the only way you can think about it, if you have this dynamic conception of the whole process, that is also circular. Now, what does this then tell us about the self? So he basically says that the selves are these emergent units, what I've just described. They are, you might say, almost like these intersections of these dialectics. That is why he refers to them as virtual selves sometimes, or selfless selves, because they don't really have a certain substantial something. They are not static things. They are these loopy processes which acquire a certain stability. So once you have this emergent whole appearing, this is what he would refer to as the self. So you do have a certain unity which, you know, it can behaviorally interact with other unities. So it's not just a mirage, just a epiphenomenon or anything like that. But at the same time, it doesn't really have a substantial something, essence. Yeah, it is not a certain something, because it is precisely a certain equilibrium between these ongoing dynamics that occur. So, you have this. For example, in the living cell, we had the metabolic processes which are constantly occurring, and they give rise to this unity, which can also occur only if there is like an ongoing exchange between the outside and this unit. So this unit does constitute itself as a distinct phenomenon, which has its own, as he calls it, phenomenology. It kind of brings forth, for example, the domain of the biological, which is different from the domain of the physical. But at the same time, you cannot really, you know, capture it. You cannot really say, oh, it's a thing, it's an entity, it's a something. For this reason, he refers to the self as being virtual or selfless. And when it comes to human beings, and again, there is a problem here I will get into in a second. He will basically say that we are the human beings, or the complex organisms in general, we are the meshworks of selfless selves. What he means by that is that you basically consist of a lot of these types of self, virtual selves. So, you know, you have cells. So there are a lot of cellular cells in you. Then you have immune system. Like I said, according to Varela, immune system also behaves as an closed system. So that's another self, immune self. And then you have your neural system, which is also a closed system. And then you have a neurocognitive self. And then you're embedded in this specific cultural framework, which provides for the narrative cultural self. So this is why he says that we are meshwork of these selfless selves. Now, the question that emerges, of course, is how do they come together? What does it mean to be a meshwork of selfless self? He never articulates this. He does not provide an answer. He does not tell you what it means, you know, whether this means that a distinct, novel, emergent unit has to appear, which is distinct, and then these other selfless selves are just somehow constituent dynamics within it. This he does not explain. However, the idea is to kind of develop a very dynamic processual idea of selfhood, which would acknowledge the existence and reality of the self, but in a way that does not lead to a certain, let's say, reification of self, but understands it dynamically, something that is kind of constantly co-constituting itself, having to keep itself being there, so to speak. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does make sense.
Okay.
Now, I know you wanted to keep this roughly around an hour, and there's something...
No problem whatsoever. We can expand it if you want.
Well, I just wanted to make sure that there was time for something that really intrigued me from the papers that you sent, which was, you know, you said Varela passed away at 54, fairly young. Mm-hmm. But I believe it's near the end, he has a liver transplant,
mm-hmm.
and his own work becomes sort of entwined in his understanding of this liver transplant that he has. Mm-hmm. And I think you said to me that this is somewhat actually has become kind of important in understanding Varela is this, his, you know, his philosophical relationship with his own liver transplant, which is mm-hmm. really intriguing.
Yeah. What you're referring to. So he was having liver problems throughout almost the whole 1990s. So it was an ongoing problem. And as you said, at some point he actually had to undergo a liver transplant, and he wrote a very, very nice piece, which I would recommend everyone to read. It's called Intimate Distances. And it is like a very reflective piece. It's an attempt, to produce a phenomenology of the experience of liver transplant. So he uses a lot of different themes in post-Husserlian phenomenology, and he really tries to apply them to his own experience. And the central theme is basically has to do with, I was talking about previously, when I was talking about, again, about living beings and this twofold dynamics, twofold dialectics, he's kind of describing it from a first-person perspective, from the perspective of his lived experience and his own relationship to his own corporeality, to his own lived body, lived corporeality. And the central theme, the central topic, the one that's also most interesting, I think, is just to this dual aspectivity of our corporeality, how our lived body is at the same time our most intimate anchor. It is like, you know, that particular thing within which we find ourselves and out of which we enter into the world and engage with others. But at the same time, how this particular intimacy, this most intimate something, if I may refer to it as such, is always already suffused with certain otherness, with certain alterity. So he uses his particular example as an extreme example, because he literally attains, you know, the liver of another human being. And he's talking about how now, you know, this new organ has intruded his own corporeality and is being incorporated into it, and what the implications are, and how the whole network of all the people who are involved in this process, you know, the donor himself who had to die somewhere, and then the technical team who took care of the liver, and the surgeons, and the whole technological development, and these body technologies that allow for this to happen, how basically they are in a certain sense reflected in himself, in his own new aliveness. And how this kind of plays out, so that, you know, you're never fully enclosed within you, but you're always kind of co-determined by the otherness. And this is the extreme case, but then he also uses like very, very mundane cases or examples as well. And he draws, for example, on Derrida here. Mm-hmm. And he could have also easily drawn on late Husserl or Merleau-Ponty. He talks, for example, of the famous example of one hand touching the other. Mm-hmm. So you have two hands that you put together, and in a certain sense, you know, that the bodily loop is closed. So, you know, with your arms, you kind of split into two. They have a common root, but then they go into different ways. And when you bring the arms together, you kind of close the loop. But here's the thing. You can never close it in a way where, for example, the two hands would feel each other simultaneously. One will always be the one that is feeling and the other one the object. And then you can switch it, the other one becoming the one that is feeling and the object. So they can interweave, but they can never fully coalesce. So you have this, this is what he refers to by intimate distances. You have a closeness, a certain connection, a link, association, which however never leads to fusion. And this basically brings us back to the very beginning. You asked me, what was his, you know, what was his topic? What was his theme? The role and nature of mind in the universe, whereby this mind would not be completely severed, and at the same time, it would not be completely fused with the universe. So you would have some sort of a non-dual account, so to speak. And he wrote a very famous and a very interesting piece. I think I sent you that piece as well. In 1976, that's called Not One, Not Two. So neither monism, neither dualism. So what is there in this in-betweenness? And he is literally in this particular text, again, a very beautiful text, trying to describe this particular experience, yeah, of this intimacy which always is kind of permeated with the otherness, and this otherness that always kind of brings with it this intimacy, and so on and so forth.
Well, considering that we've managed to make it a complete loop, which is very Varelian,
very Varelian,
probably a good place to finish up. But I will ask, where to begin with his work?
Okay,
which is probably the toughest question, right?
In a certain sense, it is. But at the same time, there are at least two very good options. Now, before I say what these options are, a brief qualification. Basically, you already said this qualification at the very beginning. So these two options will give the reader a very specific perspective on Varela's work. And from this, then the reader has to read around to also see and get to know the other aspects. But two books that are most accessible are The Tree of Knowledge, that was co-authored by Umberto Maturana. So Francisco Varela, written by Francisco Varela and Umberto Maturana in 1987, if I'm not mistaken. And The Embodied Mind, which was published in 1991 and was written by Varela, Thompson, and Roche. These are very good starting points. I would also maybe recommend some of the articles. So one article I would recommend is Neurophenomenology from 1996. Then The Intimate Distances that we were talking about, which is a very, very personal account. The reader can also try with Not One, Not Two, although it's a very wacky paper. And there was one more I wanted to mention, but it slipped my mind. I mean, I think that that's a good start.
I'll try to find some of these and put the links in the description below.
Marvelous, yeah. They're all. Oh, I just remembered. Varela's own experience with the Chilean Civil War. That's also a very, very good text. It's a very personal text, and he also accounts for. He also explains why he found this circularity to be so important. Not just, you know, when you're observing the phenomena, but also in your own epistemology, why it is important to have an epistemology that allows you to pull the rug under your own feet, which means that allows you to restructure your views and has this mechanism kind of incorporated into it. So a very, very nice text as well.
Okay. Well, be sure to put as many of them as I can find in the description below. I mean, what are you working on now?
Well, the biggest project I'm working on, and this is also something we were talking about, is the book on Varela. So after a very promising start, I've now ended up in a little bit of a rut, but I'm sure I will get out of it sooner or later. So that's my main focus currently, this particular book. And then I have some other projects in mind, a book on basically the phenomenon of life. And then if all goes well, one that would address the question of life versus so vitality and mentality, also something that I mentioned at the beginning.
Well, those both sound fascinating, and hopefully I'll get a chance to talk to you about them when they release.
I'd be happy to, James.
But I think it's been a good discussion on Varela. Very recursive loop on Varela. Sebastian Wyrsch, thank you very much.
Thank you very much for having me here, James. Be well.